Greetings, greetings, fellow WhoGazers, and welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, the podcast taking you through the world of the Target novelizations in publication order. My name is Jason, and I'm your host on this journey, this very long journey. I'm recording this segment on Saturday, April 9th, and it is Tartan Week here in New York City. And today was the New York City Tartan Day Parade, the first one since 2019, the last two having been unable to proceed as live events because of the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. This year, the Grand Marshal was Karen Gillan, who is incandescently hot these days. However, the press release from the Tartan Parade still refers to her first credit as Doctor Who. I was desperately hoping to go and see her as the Grand Marshal. Unfortunately, I was not able to make it on time today due to New York City's subway train delays and then family obligations, but I'm going to soldier on and record this podcast anyway. Coincidentally, in my rewatch, you can follow my rewatch on Twitter at Doctor Who Pilgrimage, that's Dr. Who Pilgrimage. I am up to the end of Series 5, the 2010 series, the first Stephen Moffat series, and I just watched Vincent and the Doctor, which features a lot of Scottish accents between Karen Gillan and Tony Curran. A few nights ago, I'll be watching the Pandorica Opens a little bit later tonight, and as this podcast drops on Sunday, I'll be a few hours away from watching The Big Bang before I finish up with Series 5 altogether. This has actually been a pretty exciting week here in the States for Doctor Who watching, and not just for those of you who were able to see Karen Gillan in the New York City Tartan Day Parade on Saturday. I received, on back-to-back days, my Season 17 Blu-rays, the U.S. release in the plastic case, and then I received my Blu-ray of the Galaxy 4 animation. Trap One has already released the episode breaking down Season 17, and I will be hosting the Galaxy 4 animation breakdown episode of Trap One probably in a couple weeks' time. And I had the chance to watch the color version of Episode 1 of Galaxy 4 today and listen to some of the audio commentaries, Toby Haydock, Maureen O'Brien, Peter Purvis. It is great to hear Maureen O'Brien on the audio commentaries, by the way. She has a lot of strongly held opinions about an episode that was shot 57 years ago, and it's wonderful to hear. And I can't wait to hear the rest. I know she's back on the Episode 4 commentary as well. The color animation for Galaxy 4 is gorgeous, especially the outer space stuff. And it's interesting to watch. I did the Hartnell portion of my pilgrimage between October and December 2020. That's now just about a year and a half ago. And I'm very much now more used to the visual language of the new series. So it's interesting to go back and watch the first 6 minutes of Galaxy 4, which is how long it takes the Doctor and Stephen and Vicky to exit the TARDIS. It's a very different pace. But having the color animation certainly helps bridge that gap, as well as the return of the text commentaries, which is something I really wish they had done for the new series box sets, which they haven't. Maybe one day we'll get classic series episode notes, production notes, the same way that we get for the classic series box sets. Now, this week, I've also booked an upcoming appearance on the Doctor Who Target Book Club podcast, the original. They're going in story order, and I'll be showing up in their Season 17 rotation in a few more weeks. I will certainly give you more details about that as the time comes, and hopefully you're all listening to Tony Witt and his crew on the Doctor Who Target Book Club podcast as well, and you'll be able to hear that as soon as it drops. Now, an interesting photo surfaced on Twitter this week as well. A Twitter user named Andrew Orton, at Andrew Orton, has been posting set photos from the classic series. This week he has posted sets from The Five Doctors and from The Ark in Space. These are overhead views of the studio, I assume shot from the lighting gantries, so you can see all of the sets laid out in the various Television Center studios. And it just brings back so many memories. You can actually, in the mind's eye, see Peter Davison and the other characters in the Five Doctor sets or in Tom Baker in the Ark in Space sets. Which leads to a point that I'm going to be making later on in this episode about today's book, Doctor Who and the Ice Warriors, because Ice Warriors is one of those stories that was shot in Lime Grove Studio D, Doctor Who's original home and home to much of the Troughton era, a very cramped studio that gave rise in the mid-1960s to the Base Under Siege story, of which Ice Warriors is a classic example. That means that Ice Warriors is an ambitious visual story. It is set on the glaciers, and it is set on the Ice Warriors spaceship, and it is set in the many rooms of Britannica's base, but it is all shoehorned into a very small studio, and that means that instead of having a lot of action, a lot of the action is converted into dialogue, philosophical debates between various sets of characters. This can be frustrating if you're not used to the visual language of 1960s television, and especially if you're watching the Ice Warriors in movie format in 2.5 hours in one night. Doesn't quite work. I think Ice Warriors works tremendously well for what it's trying to do, given the confines of the studio in which it's set. And if you look at the Andrew Orton photos and see how many sets are crammed together into a small space, and Lime Grove Studio D was certainly much smaller than anything in Television Center, I think it'll give you a much greater appreciation for what the classic series was able to do on limited space and budget, and tell these imaginative stories with rich dialogue. Ice Warriors, of course, being a good example of that. We'll now start my discussion with Fraser Gregory about Doctor Who and the Ice Warriors. Let's get to it. And welcome back to episode 21, and I have a returning guest. This is famously the Doctor Who story with Angus Leeny as the short, hairy, northern Scottish scavenger. So who better to join me for this recording? He's hairy, he's northern, he's Fraser. Fraser, welcome back to the show.
Welcome. Thank you, Jason. That's a brilliant introduction. I'm not quite that northern. I'm not quite north of the wall, as we would say. I'm not quite a wildling, but yeah, not far off.
I just vividly remember when you were on one of the Trap 1 episodes talking about the Flux. You were talking about Carvanista, who's also hairy and northern. So the phrasing has stuck in my head, so...
Yeah, hairy and northern, that'll be me. That'll be me. But yeah, thank you very much for having us back. It's been, it feels like, thousands of years ago, trapped in the ice since we were last here talking about the Sea Devils. So it's really great to be back. Thank you very much.
Now you've awakened and you are back to conquer, and I have to figure out if your engines are radioactive and will clash with the podcast recording device.
No, I think my engines died a long time ago, so you're quite safe.
I had you on for episode 9, as you mentioned, Doctor Who and the Sea Devils. That was about 3 months ago by Showtime, and hopefully we'll get you back for a return appearance that is not quite so far down the road. I'm happy to announce that I am now booked just about 6 months in advance.
It's been a while, because you've managed to get quite a good range of people on this podcast. It's really impressive. Well done.
Thank you. And you gave me a big shout out on a recent episode of Gallifrey's Most Wanted, the Runcible Report. You see, my podcast stack is now about 6 or 7 weeks lagged. So I just heard you and Simon on Runcible Report. And you and Ross both mentioned being on my show in your recording. So I was, even though I heard the shout out 6 or 7 weeks late, I very much appreciated it.
No, but I'm glad you're managing to get caught up eventually.
Every week I fall further and further behind. I've got to have to.
It's a slippery slope, isn't it? Once you start, you start listening to one, and then another one piques your interest, and so it just builds and builds until you've got no time left, and all you're doing is talking about Doctor Who, or reading Doctor Who, or watching Doctor Who, or listening to someone else talk about Doctor Who, and.
I make it a rule that if I have like back-to-back Doctor Who podcasts in my queue. I will save one for the next day and listen to something else non-Doctor Who in between, because otherwise my brain gets inundated. For example, I know that I listened to you and Cy on an episode of Runcible Report, and it was only in the last 2 or 3 days, and I can no longer for the life of me remember what the topic of the episode was.
Was it the season 22 box set?
Yes, that was the one, the season 22 box set preview, because the box set hasn't actually been released yet.
No, and we're still no closer to getting it by the look of it. I think the last I read on the internet was possibly June for that, due to staff shortages in the factory where it's made in Poland. Obviously, the war, the situation in Ukraine affecting them as well, and COVID has knocked that back. So it's potentially June for that one.
Yeah, my last Ukrainian grandparent fled the country in 1905 after a pogrom and landed in New York. So I may still have distant Ukrainian relatives left behind, but I would have no way of knowing. I don't know if I still have people in that fight, but it's a horrible situation to follow. And I'm just really glad that the Ukrainians have put up the fight they did and have, for the moment, driven the Russians out.
Yeah, they've done a great job. But like you say, it's a horrible situation for everyone. And obviously my thoughts and support are with everyone in the Ukraine at the minute having to deal with that.
So I'm actually supposed to receive today. Here I am doing a ham-handed segue to a happier topic. I'm supposed to be receiving both the Season 17 Blu-ray, the U.S. edition in the plastic case, and the U.S. edition of the animated Galaxy 4. So the Galaxy 4 was supposed to arrive on Tuesday, and I keep getting apologetic emails from Amazon that they haven't been able to deliver, so it's not here yet. And my season 17 is supposed to arrive, but it's not here yet. So if at some point the doorbell rings during this recording and I have to pause you, it means that my season 17 has arrived. And I have to run down and grab it from the Amazon delivery worker.
That's absolutely fine. You can leave your podcast in safe hands with me, much safer than Mr. Ford.
Yes, I left Mr. Ford in charge of the show for 1 minute so I could pull my copy of Enlightenment out of the back bedroom. And he took liberties with the recording format.
What can I say? You invited him on. You left him alone. What else was going to happen?
I should have known better. I should have known that you do not leave a guy like Joe alone with the microphone.
Oh, we love you, Joe. We really do.
But we are here today to judiciously discuss Doctor Who and the Ice Warriors, the March 1976 novelization, and sadly, the final bit of Doctor Who fiction that Brian Hales ever put to paper. Now, Fraser, before we started recording, you and I played a game of I'll show you mine if you show me yours. And we discovered that we have very, very different quality copies of the novelization.
Yeah.
So I have the 1984 reprint, the 6th edition, which is the first version that was sold commercially in the States, distributed by Lyle Stewart Enterprises. Lyle Stewart is a fascinating figure, by the way, heavily involved in the mythology of Mad Magazine. And I guess he spent the later part of his career trafficking Doctor Who books to the United States. That's an odd pop culture junction. But I have the blue logo, which is unusual because when you're looking at the Ice Warriors, you would expect that a green logo is aesthetically pleasing. But you have this bright blue logo over a dark green Bernard Breslau.
Yeah.
And I have... The original back cover blurb was not updated for the 1980s, as some of the back cover blurbs were. But you have, I believe, is yours a second edition?
No, I think mine's the original.
The original.
To be honest, looking inside the cover there, it's got the 1976 copyright with no other years in it. Looking at the also available in the Target series, you know, it goes quite just up to Dinosaur Invasion. There's nothing after that, so... This is looking like the original version to me.
A lot of the 1984 books in the back have a list of upcoming titles, but this book ends with the last page, page 144, and there's no buffer pages going to the back cover. It just ends flat.
Yeah, snap. Same here.
There's no list of what books you could buy. But your copy also has a border around the front and the back covers, which is very rare. I don't think I've ever seen that on any of my targets.
Yeah. Yeah, Meaty just helps frame everything nicely. I'm glad that we've both got the Chris Achilleos artwork on the front, which is, you know, Bernard Breslau's Ice Warriors jazz hands.
With the remarkable sonic waves coming out of his claws and menacing a screaming Deborah Watling.
Yeah, it's iconic, that, isn't it? That well, the cover itself, but obviously that pose from Debbie Watling screaming in terror.
Publicity photo. Although, to be fair, that might be Sonny Caldinez and not Bernard Breslau, because Sonny Caldinez was the ice warrior who menaced her in the ice tunnels.
Did he not have the more dome-shaped helmet, though?
It's interesting because in episode one, Bernard Breslau is wearing the dome-shaped helmet, but after the cliffhanger, he reverts to the regular helmet. And then somebody else wore that strange helmet. I'm not sure if it was Sonny Caldinez or not.
It was. Bear with us. Because there's the two main warriors, it's Varga and Zondal, are the ones who have got the helmet like what's on our cover. And then the other ones have got the more, let's say, sort of dome-shaped one, which is a bit of a sort of a ranking thing in this. It's like if you have the bigger helmet, you're lower rank. But then when you get to like the other Ice Warrior stories, which is especially in like Seeds of Doom.
Well, by the Seeds of Doom is the crinoid. It's a different kind of dome entirely. you've got a plant monster with a 60-foot dome over its trunk. But in Seeds of Death, which is not nearly as good as Seeds of Doom, apologies to my few Seeds of Death fans, you have the change from the Ice Warriors to the Ice Lords. So you have now Alan Bennion in a much sleeker costume with a slim helmet. But I have found on Google Images, and I apologize to my listeners, nothing is less exciting than hearing somebody else do a Google search in the background. But you are right. I found the famous photo of Sonny Caldinez looming over Deborah Watling's screaming form with styrofoam snow in her hair. And you're right. It is that weird dome-shaped helmet, which shows up in a few later stories, but is never actually explained on screen as being a class signifier. And there's another photo of Zondal on Google Images, which has the same helmet as Bernard Breslau. So you are correct. And that must be Bernard Breslau on the cover. I'll tell you, when I first got my copy of Ice Warriors, would have been on a Saturday in 1985. At this point, I'd already purchased the program guide by the L'Officiers. I'd been a Doctor Who fan for less than a year. And I knew that Ice Warriors was one of those stories that was classic and iconic, because it introduced the Ice Warriors who kept coming back and back throughout the 1970s. And when I got the book, I brought it home and I started reading, and I kept reading and I kept reading. And I felt the same frustration that I would later feel reading the New Adventures in the 1990s, where they would play a game of how deep into the book can you go before the Doctor first shows up. And I vividly recall the TARDIS does not show up until page 17, which isn't as bad as it sounds because the book starts on page 7.
Yeah.
But you're waiting an awfully long time. And it's actually page 18 the TARDIS shows up. So you're waiting 11 pages before you get your first glimpse of the TARDIS crew, which means that these guest characters that I never would have heard of are doing a lot of heavy lifting until the Doctor and company actually show up. Regardless, this is a book that I've read more than many other targets, and it's one of my favorites. And if you heard my discussion with Ross about Brian Hales' other book, Doctor Who and the Curse of Peladon, and that was discussed back on episode 11, I think this is the better of Brian Hales' two books. I think he cuts away a lot of the excess verbiage and a lot of the unnecessary adjectives and a lot of the run-on sentences. And this was a much leaner and meaner story, where Curse of Peladon keeps adding scenes. This one takes away a lot of scenes and makes for a much tighter final project. So from your point of view, when did you first read the book? What was your initial reaction? And now that you've had a chance to watch the surviving episodes, which are finally available commercially, and the animated episodes 2 and 3, How does the book now stack up to the original TV story?
So I first read this book last year in preparation for discussing this story on Trap One when the vinyl was released and me and Mark and Pete Lambert got together to talk Ice Warriors. So because I hadn't seen the televised version at that point, I thought, but I had the novelization thanks to the gift I've mentioned before from Michael that I work with. I thought I'll read the book first and then watch the televised version, because so many people have done that, have grown up doing that. I thought this is my real opportunity. There's not that many classic stories I haven't watched yet. So this is my real opportunity to do what everyone else has done through their childhood and, you know, get introduced to it with the Target and then go into the televised version. So, like you say, the book is really, really fantastic. And I think I flew through this in one Sunday afternoon or, you know, a couple of days, but certainly the bulk of it was a Sunday afternoon, just page turning and going through. And, you know, you say that you like to spot when the Doctor comes in. I was trying to spot the cliffhangers, trying to see where, you know, the episode endings would be, and before I went and watched it. And I think it gave us a really good, you know, understanding of the story and what was going to happen. And then watching the televised version, I think just sort of enhanced that, because, you know, the televised version does have a secret weapon, which unfortunately the Target novelization is never going to have, which is Dudley Simpson.
Yes. The, you know, jazzy score with the vocals,
yeah,
over the opening titles,
yes,
as the blurry ice comes into focus and the enormous number one or three,
yeah,
or four comes on screen. When I was reading the book as a kid, I tried to read the equivalent of one episode a night, and I knew that Ice Warriors was six episodes long, so I tried to read it over six nights. Because one of the friends who got me into Doctor Who was doing this. He was trying to read an episode a night. But of course, for these older stories, we had no idea where the cliffhangers,
yeah,
were. And it was not until 1996 when I actually got a bootleg of the surviving Ice Warriors episodes. But thanks to, I think it was the Jeremy Bentham chapter in A Celebration, which is the Peter Haining book, the 20th anniversary book, Jeremy Bentham did the chapter where he does a capsule review of every Doctor Who story from seasons 1 through 20 up through King's Demons, because Five Doctors had not yet aired and wasn't in the book.
Mm-hmm.
For his capsule of Ice Warriors, he specifically mentions, and I almost remember the line verbatim, he says that the episode 2 cliffhanger is about as graphic as Doctor Who ever gets, where Varga is beckoning his frozen comrades to awake from the dead. I'm like, ah, now I have a clue. Now I know where episode 2 ends. The problem is, episode 2, the cliffhanger, occurs more than halfway through the novelization. So that means you're cramming two-thirds of the story into less than half of the text. So come to find out, the episode 4 cliffhanger takes place in the middle of a sentence.
It does. It does. And the episode 3 cliffhanger isn't actually there in the text.
Refresh my memory. I know I watched a story about a year ago when I got to the pilgrimage, the Troughton part of the pilgrimage, would have been about February of 2021. What was the episode 3 cliffhanger? It's completely vanished from my memory.
The episode 3 cliffhanger is Victoria has escaped from the Ice Warriors. You know, she's been captured by Varga, took into the Ice Warriors spaceship. She has then managed to escape and got a hold of the communicator. Arden has been killed outside, so she's escaped, got his communicator, and is talking with the Doctor and leader Clint. And the cliffhanger is that Varga and Zondal are going to destroy her with the sonic cannon. That's the cliffhanger.
Yes.
The resolution is basically that Varga decides, no, actually, we'll keep her as a hostage, we'll keep her as bait. I've changed my mind in the intervening week, and we're not going to zap her. But Just looking through the text here, it just doesn't happen. She talks to them. The Ice Warriors are listening in. They decide not to kill her. Go out and send someone out to capture instead. So that whole cliffhanger is just missing from the text. The episode 5 one is intact, but like you say, 3 and 4 are just very glossed over.
My take on mid-60s Doctor Who is that Lime Grove D, their little tiny home studio, was the show's superpower, because you couldn't do any action in Lime Grove D. There was just not enough room for any sort of corridor chase whatsoever. So you have to get the drama out of the words. So Ice Warriors is ambitious because you have this large base, you have a snowscape outside, and then you have the Ice Warriors ship. And they weren't doing this in modular fashion like they would in the late 70s and throughout the 80s, where they do, 2 days on one set, strike it, come back a week later and do the other set. So they were doing all this in the same studio at the same time. So most of Ice Warriors is characters standing around debating ethics, either in the base medical center or in Angus Leeny's plant museum.
Yeah.
Now, as I'll talk about during my review and breakdown later in the episode, a lot of those conversations are trimmed and removed from the book, because if nothing is less exciting than listening to a guy doing a Google search in the middle of a podcast, little else is less exciting than reading a long circular debate. So it's fun to watch two monsters debate whether or not to kill Victoria and then conveniently change their minds in order to resolve the cliffhanger. That's how you do a story in Lime Grove D.
Yeah.
And that's what makes 60s Doctor Who so wonderful. It just doesn't fly in a book. So what I did as a kid is I would mark off the cliffhangers when I knew them. So I'm showing you page 78, the top of chapter 5. You'll see I had originally marked off 3 in pencil, because that's when I read in A Celebration that was the cliffhanger moment.
Yeah.
After I finally watched the TV story, I wrote 3 in all capital block letters, which is how the episodes are described on TV. And then fast forwarding to page 111, I did the same for episode 5. I wrote a big 5 in the margin right in between the cliffhanger sentence.
Yeah.
But I can't find any mark for part 4, so you're right. I must have realized that part 4 was not marked off in the book, so I didn't write 4 at all anywhere.
Yeah, but I say when I read it, there was other parts which sort of like screamed a cliffhanger to me. Specifically, I think it's the end of chapter 5 that you've just shown, which, if you'll allow me to read out.
I want a dramatic reading by Fraser, yes.
For once, Arden didn't need Clint's warning. He shuddered as he began to set up the radiation detector, apprehension mingling with the enjoyment of discovery. Jamie looked about, but he could see no sign of the warrior or that Victoria had ever been here. "We'll take the readings first, Jamie," murmured Arden, "and then we'll have a look around outside for Victoria. All right?" He gave the Scots lad a quick smile. "Fair enough," agreed Jamie. He knew the importance of the mission Clint had ordered, but he was glad that Arden shared his own feelings about Victoria. "What readings are these then?" he asked as they unwound the power pack connections. "Radiation, magnetic field, ion density. It won't take long." "Just as well," muttered Jamie. "I don't much like this place, nor that door." He stared at it, frowning. "I wonder what's inside it." Arden threw him a quick, amused glance. "You don't think I'm leaving here until I've had a go open it, do you? There's never been a discovery like this before." They were the last words he ever spoke. At Varga's silent command, the warriors stepped out of the hiding and opened fire. Victoria, her mouth smothered by Varga's mighty fist, could only watch in helpless terror as Arden took the full brunt of the massive burst of sonic power. His body seemed to shimmer, almost disintegrate, beneath the invisible blast of energy. For a split second, he seemed suspended like a broken puppet, his face crumpled in agonized surprise. Then he slumped to the ground beside Jamie, as though hurled there by a giant hand. The ambush complete, Varga released the girl. She stood, trembling, staring at the two sprawled bodies on the cavern floor, her face wide-eyed with misery. "You've killed them!"
Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, Fraser Gregory.
That is a cliffhanger in my book.
I will do another one because at the end of chapter 6 is a moment that I was convinced for years would have been the part 3 or part 4 cliffhanger, because this, I mean, it's the famous publicity photo. I think a copy of that photo appears in a celebration, so I would have seen it in the mid-80s, the one with Sonny Caldinez and his bulbous helmet chasing down Debbie Watling in the one ice tunnel. Abandoning the struggle to reach the communicator, Victoria tried to draw back out of his reach, that's Turok, but she was stuck. With horror, she realized that she couldn't move. Then, just as the ice warrior's massive fist clamped down on her wrist, there came a shudder and a roar of moving ice. The body of the ice warrior was crushed by the ceiling of the tunnel as it fell on top of him. When the moment of terror had passed and the eerie silence returned, Victoria suddenly realized that the grip of the crevice around her body had loosened. She could move. Now was her chance of escape, before another movement of the glacier brought down an avalanche of ice on top of her, too. And then she discovered the grim truth. Her puny strength couldn't budge the grip of Turok's mighty fist. Even in death, he held her, a prisoner, in the heart of the moving mountain of ice. That should be a cliffhanger. It is written like a cliffhanger. This is the bottom of page 101, top of page 102. It's the end of chapter 6. And I want to point out to you, in case you missed it, Fraser, every single sentence in that paragraph ends in an exclamation point. This is DC Comics style writing, where every bit of punctuation is an exclamation point, sometimes two.
It's...
And there are some periods in the paragraphs above it. It's a three-paragraph section, but every single sentence is an exclamation point. That is desperate to be a cliffhanger. And it isn't.
No. But it is. It's both of those are screaming to be, you know, what happens next? Watch next week to find out how we get out of this. But it's not.
When did you first watch the surviving video of the Ice Warriors? Is it when the DVDs came out, or perhaps when the original VHS release with the cut down episodes 2 and 3 came out, or at some other point in your fandom journey?
It was after I'd read the book. So again, last year, I read the book first, thinking I'll read the book and then I'll watch all the episodes. So I hadn't seen a single episode, a single bit of footage. You know, all I'd seen was obviously that picture of Sonny Caldina's menacing Debbie Watling. So it was a completely new experience watching that after reading the book. I watched it on BritBox. So we got the, you know, the animation, the two animated segments for 2 and 3 and the surviving footage.
I recall my disappointment when I learned that episode 2 was missing, because ever since I read that Jeremy Bentham chapter in A Celebration, I was desperate to see that moment in surviving video when Varga asks his comrades to awake from the dead, and it's gone. I'll tell you when I first saw Ice Warriors, and if you dig deep enough back in the RecArts Doctor Who archives, I probably wrote a review at the time, but in the summer of 1996, it was in between my first and second years of law school, and I moved back to Baltimore to take on a judicial internship with Judge Burns in Baltimore City. And I was living with my ex-fiance, who at this point was dating somebody else, and that was incredibly awkward, as you can imagine.
Yes.
And the guy that she was dating, he was involved in what was then an annual Baltimore sci-fi convention, right? So she went with him to the convention as his guest. As a small remaining courtesy to me, she found in the dealer's room a bootleg VHS of the Ice Warriors with a handmade cover on the big plastic VHS clamshell cover to make it seem as if it was a commercial release. So I got this blurry nth generation bootleg VHS copy of episodes 1, 4, 5, and 6. So I watched it one evening when I was home alone, and what shocked me was that there was so much of the story that wasn't in the book, because at this point I'd had the book for almost a dozen years and I'd read the book probably a dozen times, and I was just shocked that there was a whole sequence where Penley and Jamie are dodging menacing stock footage of bears and tigers and what have you. Plus the novelty of seeing the episodes, not episode one, not part one, but one in all capital letters.
It's funny you should say about the stock footage of the bear, because that's not actually stock footage. They actually hired a bear to film on the set.
They actually hired... Now, was this in Ealing or was this in Lime Grove D?
I believe it was Ealing.
Wow.
But it was you know, brought in especially for that sequence. So, you know, when Brian Hales kind of chops it out the book, you think, the poor bear. But yeah, that's that whole sequence with Jamie being missing. When I read this book for the first time, I actually wondered, does Fraser Hines have a holiday in this? Because you have the bit where, obviously, episode three, you know, Arden's killed, Jamie's injured, and spends a lot of time sort of laid up with Penley and Storr before he gets tucked back to the base and is healed by science. And I thought, I genuinely thought this must be where Fraser Hines has had a week off to go off on holiday, and Jamie's going to be played by a stand-in with a kilt. So I was quite surprised watching it back to find that he was actually in all six episodes, because he doesn't actually have a lot to do in this at all.
And that's another major change between the televised story and the novelization that shocked me in 1996, because Jamie's character is paralyzed in part three, and he stays paralyzed until about 5 minutes before the end of the story, which is remarkably grim. And Hales cuts that out entirely. I don't think there's any reference in the book to Jamie being full-on unable to use his legs at all. And then when he recovers, it's very late in the day, and you almost have to wonder, as you're going into part six, is it going to be like this for the rest of the season? And then on television, Debbie Watling had an engagement and had to leave the studio halfway through recording, because they recorded late at night, so she's not even in the last 10 minutes. And there's no TARDIS scene of the three of them piling into the TARDIS and leaving, because she wasn't there to do it.
No, it's a very swift end, we're done, we're fixed, let's fly off. I quite like it, to be honest. I think it's a nice visual of them looking around and just seeing the TARDIS disappear. It's curious who actually put it back the right way up, because when it lands, it's upside down on its side. So, you know, who's actually put the TARDIS back up for it to leave like that is never explained, but it's still a nice way to end the episode. What do you think of Victoria's role in the story?
I am a huge fan of Debbie Watling and Victoria. I know that the character has had a bad reputation in fandom because she's most famous for screaming. And when I went back and read... I wasn't reading the blog at the time, but when I went back and I bought the ebook of Elizabeth Sandifer's TARDIS Eruditorum volume on the Second Doctor, she's very critical of Victoria's role. I think calling her a peril monkey, I think was the term they used to describe Victoria.
A what?
I think Debbie Watling gave her all to the series, and she does really good work. And her flirtation with Jamie here, and then when you fast forward to the end of Fury from the Deep, when Victor Pemberton is writing it as a full-on relationship and a breakup scene, the series gave her a lot of great dramatic moments. And also, of course, the moment that Victor Pemberton added to Tomb of the Cybermen, where she and the Doctor are discussing her dead father and his lost family. So you have this tremendously appealing actress, and she's given a lot more drama than just being a screaming peril monkey, to use the phrase. She's a very strong character in this book, I think, even though she is completely out of her depth, dealing with a technologically advanced alien from another planet, and she does spend a lot of the book trembling. She shows Varga a lot of fire, and she resists him, and she manages to escape at one point, and she survives these terrible, terrible disasters, like being locked to a dead alien while trapped under a moving glacier. I think it's a great book for Victoria, because even though she's in a lot of danger, the way that she reacts to it, she's not just your screaming damsel in distress. She has a lot of agency, and she fights back, and she gives as good as she gets. What's your take on her?
Very much the same. You know, I'm a big, massive fan of Victoria as a character, and obviously Deborah Watling as well, as the performance that she gives. I think the important thing to remember with Victoria is that she is not there by choice. She is, you know, a companion who is not, you know, chosen to join the Doctor on his travels. She has kind of got no choice. She's orphaned at the end of, you know, Evil of the Daleks. My dad's, you know, dying wishes that the Doctor takes care of her, which he does. So she's kind of forced into these situations, and, you know, she's forced into danger, forced into, you know, perilous situations with Cybermen and Ice Warriors and Yetis, you know. And so when it comes to Fury from the Deep, and when she decides to leave, that's, for me, is probably one of the best departures of any of the companions that we have, because along with sort of Joe Grant, it's spelled out throughout the story. It's when you get to that point, you know that Victoria's fed up with, you know, that she's come to the end of the line, really, and she just wants, you know, a bit of safety and a bit of normality in her life. So you always need to remember that. But as well, it's important to remember that this, as a character, the damsel in distress serves a purpose. You know, in this book in particular, you know, someone needs to be inside the Ice Warrior spaceship to be giving us the perspective of the story. So that is Victoria's role, is to be there, to be our in, as it were, our eyes and ears on that situation. It's interesting because it's a fine balance, I think, in this book between her being quite damsel-y and quite strong and fiery. I think, you know, Brian Hills writes a lot of, you know, she was nearly in tears and so on and so forth, which I think you can potentially take either way. I like your take on it, that, you know, she is showing a lot of strength and a lot of spirit in standing up to Varga, and, you know, despite being, you know, really terrified. I really like that take on it, Jason. Because, like you say, you know, she is a Victorian upper class sheltered girl who is now being thrown into situations that us as, you know, 21st century guys would be, you know, would struggle with if this was to happen to us.
So that makes her the audience identification figure, much more so than Jamie, who was absent from the book. Victor Pemberton was heavily involved in, well, the end of season 4, which is when they shot Tomb of the Cybermen, and then beginning of season 5 up through Fury from the Deep. And he had, I don't want to say this in a pejorative sense, he had a soap opera sensibility in that he wasn't just moving Cypher characters around a sci-fi chessboard. He was interested in the emotion behind the character. So the scenes that he added to Tomb with the Doctor and Victoria, and then he added a scene for Abominable Snowman between Debbie Watling and David Spencer, who happened to be the author's partner, Victor Pemberton. They lived together for decades. But he gave the two of them this scene where they're discussing the Doctor's immortality. So anytime Victor Pemberton gets his hands on a script, he adds these character moments, which are really not in evidence in so much of surrounding Doctor Who. You certainly weren't getting it in Series 4. You weren't getting it in Series 6 or Series 7 with Zoe or Liz Shaw or, you know, the end of the Ben and Polly era. Now, Brian Hales will one-up that. And here's a paragraph, and maybe I'll go back and add some appropriate music to this as a track as I'm playing it back. Laboratory. This is page 45. Jamie had at last given Victoria a turn in the vibro chair. As the almost imperceptible tingling began, she closed her eyes and smiled with childish delight. I mean, hello. I think Brian Hales was enjoying himself a little too much there.
Right, so
coming into this, I had marked out a couple of passages which I wanted to read out. You've went with the bottom of chapter 45. I've actually went with the preceding page on page 44. And I realise I'm probably going to get a few Brigadier Gifts and Stopwits out of certain people for this, but half playfully, she struggled to prize Jamie out of the vibro chair. Not because the doctor had told them not to touch it, because she dearly wanted to have a go in it herself. "Me first," she shouted, then gasped as she felt the machine tingle into life, switched on by Jamie's eager hand as he relaxed into the chair.
The eager hands of Fraser Hines. If you want to see more of the eager hands of Fraser Hines, watch any scene where he feels up Wendy Padbury in season 6. Tonight, on the eager hand of Fraser Hines, 8, 7 Central and Mountain.
That's the end of episode 1. It's very different in the book. Jamie mentions the outfits that everyone in Britannica Space is wearing, and is a bit flirtatious with Victoria as to whether she'd want one. There's nothing about tingling machines or Jamie's eager hands at all.
Yes, he's teasing her about the short skirts worn by the base female personnel, yeah. If memory serves me right. So how does this book capture Patrick Troughton? And I'll tell you what I mean. There was this axiom in the 1990s when The Missing Adventures started to come out that Patrick Troughton's Doctor was impossible to capture in print because the character was so mercurial and playful and visual. And if you read a lot of the Second Doctor Missing Adventures, The Menagerie by Martin Day or Twilight of the Gods, which is really Return to the Web Planet by Chris Bulis, a lot of the Second Doctor books don't really write for Troughton. They're just writing for generic Doctor in a far out spacey, sci-fi, monstery setting, but they don't really have the ability to capture Patrick Troughton in print. And those are authors that I have tremendous respect for in their other books, but Patrick Troughton is perhaps a bit of a tough assignment, especially when you're a relatively new writer. However, I think the lie to that axiom is given by the novelizations, because reading Abominable Snowmen and Doctor Who and the Cybermen, which were the two Patrick Troughton stories novelized before this one, I think the books do a great job of capturing Troughton as he was on camera. How did you picture the Second Doctor here?
I thought this struggled a little bit, to be honest. When I first read it, there was sort of a lot of vocabulary which I wouldn't associate with the Second Doctor. He calls Jamie Ladd quite a few times. There's a few chaps in there which kind of threw us. I thought that Second Doctor doesn't call people chap. When I watched it, actually, he does, and it did feel quite natural. I said, all right, fair enough. But I think, yeah, a lot of times he refers to Jamie as lad. Jamie lad, or all right, lad. And it's a bit like, what it struck us was more Wallace and Gromit, which is probably because I had Peter Salas in my head. But the other part that I've marked out to discuss this is, again, this is a scene there, but the dialogue is completely different from the book to what happens in the televised version. And it's where the Doctor and Clint's just kind of recovering from being attacked by Varga. They've realised that he was in the base the whole time. Now he's escape with Victoria, so they all want to go out and search for Victoria, but Clint wants them to go out and check for the spaceship, and they're having a bit of argument on that. So the passage goes, "Of course," replied the Doctor, forcing himself to sound cheerful. "Now that all your gear's ready, you can set out at first light. And it isn't as if we don't know where he's going to go, is it?" Clint, now fully recovered, cut in sharply. "How many times do I have to remind you, Doctor," he snapped, "that we are not chasing monsters all over that ice mountain?" "You really are very dense sometimes, Clint, old chap," observed the Doctor. "With any luck, this creature will do our job for us. If there is a spacecraft, he'll lead us to it, don't you see?" "You really are very dense sometimes, Clint," is not a sentence I would associate with the Second Doctor. That kind of really stuck out to me. And I remember when I was discussing this on Trap One last year, that someone on Twitter commented that at the time that Brian Hales wrote this novelization, he'd been writing for the Third Doctor more. So he was more in the mindset of writing for the Third Doctor than the Second. And I can see that a little bit, but it just, you know, would the Third Doctor even call someone a bit dense? I'm not entirely sure.
I think the Third Doctor would have used much more stronger language, because the Third Doctor is the Doctor who had a lot of his words supplied by Robert Holmes, which is where you come up with ham-fisted bun vendor and things along those lines. But Patrick Troughton's Doctor on TV spent a lot of time protesting in a high-pitched voice, in a higher register than he normally used. So if you imagine Clint, you're really very dense. And the way that Troughton raised his voice when he was agitated, I can hear it. And there's also the moment where he is trying to awaken Clint using smelling salts that he dials from the machine. And he realizes that it's going to be stinky and it's going to bother Clint. And he gets a twinkle in his eye as he waves the smelling salts under Clint's nose. Anyway, that was very Troughton-esque.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the first scene as well of the Doctor in the base. I know, you know, going back to what you said at the start, that the TARDIS doesn't turn up for 10 pages. I don't think that's necessarily a problem, because there's a lot of world building needs to be done at the start of this book. You know, when you're in the televised version, when you've got a script and you've got visuals, you can tell a story a lot, you know, easier. You can, you know, just put, you know, Arden and Walters and Davis on the ice front and have a little bit of exposition, and you can watch and you can make it up. When you've got a novel, we've got prose, you do have to be a bit more, you have to explain a bit more what's going on, you know, in terms of there's an ice age and, you know, this, that, and the other. So it does take a little while to get going, but I think that's just because there's a lot of world to build. But that first scene where the Doctor goes into, you know, he has that the ionizer is not right just by listening to it, and he goes in and, you know, he says, there's going to be an almighty explosion in, you know, 2 minutes and 38 seconds. And that's a brilliant scene, and it's very well realized in the book as well. That really, you know, sings as well as something that's very Doctorish, which you don't always see with Patrick Troughton. You see him being more as the, you know, the Doctor who plays down his intelligence, but he really sticks it. He has a lot of technical dialogue, which is really quite on the money as well. So I love that opening part.
A similar Troughton scene that I really enjoyed is when he is about to be expelled from the base and put on a flight to Africa to get away from the ice. And he's trying to persuade Clint to hire him on staff. And Clint starts interrogating him about how you solve the problem of the advancing glaciers. And the Doctor tries to solve the mystery by reading his base badge upside down. To read the word ionizer upside down and come up with the missing word ionization. That moment is so tensely written. When I was trying to read the book over 6 nights and 6 episodes, I thought that was the part one cliffhanger, because it is a very tense moment, and it occurs about 1/6 of the way through the book. Whereas the actual cliffhanger comes on page 44 or 45, which is much, much later on in the text. So that was a moment that stuck in my head, because I wouldn't have seen much of the Second Doctor at this point. We didn't get the Patrick Troughton episodes in syndication on PBS until late 85, and I would have gotten the book several months earlier. So all I would have known about the Second Doctor was his scenes in The Five Doctors. So this book for me was very instrumental in making me a Second Doctor fan.
Yeah.
And although I was very disappointed in the era, watching it back on my pilgrimage last year, it was always with the writing and the really bad behind-the-scenes chaos that always left them short of stories, whereas Troughton's Doctor is always a delight. And this book, again, is one of the reasons why I'm such a big fan of him and his era. I want to talk about some of the other characters as well, because what Hales never does is give us any description as to what the characters look like. I got a clearly defined sense of who Arden is by his personality, and Davis and Walters. You know who Walters is because he's a security sergeant and he's burly. Every sergeant in Doctor Who ever has been described with burly. Angus Leany in this book is described as burly too, as he also was described as burly in Terror of the Zygons, the novelization of the Loch Ness Monster. Obviously, Angus Leeny, whose most famous character in the movies is called the Mole, was not Burly. No. That's perhaps an overused word. But I got a sense of who these characters were, but Hales never really describes them as how they look, right?
No. No. There's not much of a description of the Ice Warriors themselves either. There's no, you know, sort of paragraph I can read out, which is a, you know, like a good sort of like Terence Dick style, he has your monster. But yeah, you're right, there's no descriptions, but the characters themselves are quite well defined and quite obvious as well. You know, you've got Miss Garrett, who's Jan in the book, but Jane on TV. Is that right?
I don't remember that.
Well, I was watching at BritBox with the subtitles on, and she's referred to as Jane by BritBox. It might just be they can't understand Peter Salas's Yorkshire accent when he's saying Jan. But yeah, it's another part where the televised version has a bit of a secret weapon against the target. Unfortunately, is the design of the costumes as well. You know, those Britannica space uniforms, which are like sort of like ink swirls, and those heated suits are really, really excellent as well. So it's a shame that hasn't actually come over in the book.
Those were really interesting costumes, very, very 1960s pattern. And you're right, I'm looking at the online transcript, Chrissy's transcript page. And yeah, episode 3. Henley refers to her as Jane several times in a very long scene set in the plant museum. So you're right, he changes from Jane to Jan between script and book.
Yeah.
Although Penley is still Elric Penley.
Elric,
both
yes.
In the book and in the transcript.
Do we get Clent's first name at all, or is it just those two that we get the first names for?
I think his first name is Leader. He's only ever called Leader Clent.
Well, you know, kind of touching on that long scene in the plant museum, what do you think of the pacing of this as in terms of the novel and in terms of the televised version?
I'm going to talk about this a little more when I read my review ad at the end of the broadcast. But on TV, there's a lot of circular dialogue arguments between Penley and Storr. And I want to talk about them, too, before we wrap up. In the book, a lot of those arguments are cut out. You definitely get the sense that Storr is kind of an antagonist. He's very opposed to science, and he's very much a back to nature kind of guy. I don't think the plant museum is described in the book as a plant museum the way that it is on TV.
No.
Angus Leeny is obviously not burly and not nearly as menacing as Storr's character in the book, who is scary and physically imposing. But in the book, Storr knocks Penley out, I think, in order to win an argument, which doesn't happen on television. On TV, they just argue and argue and argue. So Hales cuts a lot of that out and replaces it with a fist fight, which is interesting because when I watched it on television, I got the sense that Storr and Penley were being coded as a same-sex couple. That was the impression that I got. It doesn't really come across so much in the book, especially because they have, you know, it becomes physically abusive where one knocks the other out. But it is a different chemistry between the two of them on television as to what you get in the book.
Yeah. There is a reading of Clent and Penley as being a couple as well. Because, you know, it's mentioned, you know, Penley left. There was an argument. Penley left. The exact ins and outs of that argument is never fully explained in either the novelization or the televised version. So there is a reading that they were a couple and it was a lover's tiff, and that's why they went separate ways. And obviously now Penley's shacked up with another man in the hills, and that's why that drives that whole you know, conflict between those two characters. Storr is a really interesting character nowadays, I feel, because he's very recognisable in terms of anti-science, anti-medicine, anti-vaccine. We know we have a lot of Storrs on the internet nowadays, I feel. He's a bit of a caricature in terms of how black and white his thinking is. You know, he is, I don't like science, so I don't like medicine. Scientists are bad. Anyone who also doesn't like these scientists is going to be my friend, which ultimately leads to his death, because that's the argument, is that he wants to go and, you know, join forces with the Ice Warriors. He wants the Ice Warriors to help Jamie, I think it is, who's paralyzed at the time. So he knocks Penley out to go and do that. And obviously he rescues Victoria, which is good, but, you know, ultimately dies in the end. But he seemed a very relatable figure in modern society, just for that sort of fanatical side of, you know, if so, you know, one way of thinking that we're kind of seeing today's society.
And the passage where he knocks Penley out is pretty powerful, but the passage where he is killed by the Ice Warriors, when he realizes that Varga has lost interest in him, and he realizes that he's doomed, I read that over and over again. It made a big impression on me. It's really, I thought, strong writing, because he signals in the text, we know this is not going to end well. We know it's a bad idea. Yeah. And now we're watching through his eyes as this plan craters around him and he's about to get killed. I like that kind of writing. So this is another reason why the Ice Warriors book is so impactful to me when I'm sitting there reading it at 11 years old. Now, in the book, does Peter Barkworth's character have the limp that we get on television?
Not as far as I'm aware. It's never mentioned. Again, going back, we don't get many descriptions of the characters, so it's never mentioned that he has that limp.
And we haven't talked much about the Ice Warriors in print, other than to say, of course, that he doesn't really give the Terrence Dix style description, the top to bottom of their outfit and uniform and costume. But how does Varga come across in the book? Is he sympathetic? Do you ever get a sense that this is a noble warrior who is just doing his job?
No, there's none of that sort of nobility in there for me. It is very much monster of the week. You know, you get a very good, I mean, don't get us wrong, you get a very good idea of his motivation, of what he wants to do. He wants, you know, he's come here to do a job. He wants to, you know, he was coming to scout the earth to see if it was invadable. It is, you know, that's what he's going to do. He's very much about conquest and survival, and you know, he's ruthless killer. So he is very much sort of like the monster of the week, I think. With the Ice Warriors, you don't really get anything other than that up until Mark Gatiss brings them back in Cold War and Empress of Mars. And it's a bit unfortunate, because that by that point, they try and turn them into Klingons. But we've already had RTD and Stephen Moffat try and turn the Sontarans into Klingons. So it doesn't quite work as a noble race of honourable warriors. But, you know, this period of Doctor Who, you just want the Monster of the Week, and they are, if that's what you want them to do, if you just want a, you know, a really, you know, scary monster, you've got one here. It's really, they're really effective. They do what they have been designed and written to do, and they do it very well.
But I'll give you Varga's last appearance in the book on page 143. And this is why I think Hales is writing him as not just a one-dimensional villain. And I'm going to have a dreadful time trying to do the Bernard Breslau hiss, but I'll give it my best go. Page 143. It was not power in our engines, Zondel, he rasped. It was the heat. Our greatest enemy, heat. From the Earthling's ionizer. Coughing from the fumes, he continued. A magnificent weapon. Then, still standing, he saluted his dead comrades in the Martian style. No! Surrender! He cried as he, his ship and warriors, were blasted into infinity. Now, that's his very last paragraph in the book. I think you see his nobility there. He salutes the weapon that defeated him. He salutes his dead comrades. He refuses to surrender. It's not quite played that way on television. but I think it's a very good last image of Varga. And maybe this is the thread that Terrence Dix uses when he suggests for season 9 that this time the Ice Warriors are the good guys. And then they play decoy good guys for, I think, episodes 4 and 5 of Monster of Peladon as well.
Yeah.
But you can draw a straight line from that paragraph to the rest of their appearances in Doctor Who, where they're not always just the one-dimensional bad guys. They do have this, you know, good side to them.
I wouldn't necessarily say it's a good side. It's a developed side, isn't it? It's not like, say, the Yeti, who are literally just, you know, a blunt instrument.
Robot monsters.
Exactly. They have obviously got characters. They've got names. They've got, you know, rank. They've got all the rest of it. And, you know, especially when they come back in the Seeds of Death.
Seeds of Death, yes. Seeds of Death. Good.
Yeah, you know, that's, again, you know, Hales can, you know, elaborate on that with a bit of help from Terrence Dix as well. So you can see, again, why they were a good pick to come back, because they have got that potential as well, of not just being one-dimensional villains of the week. They are villains of the week. They are monsters of the week, undoubtedly, but they are very good ones, very well thought out and well-developed ones. So yeah, that is a really good example of the layers that Brian Hales has put into his creations.
So what we're going to do next, Fraser, is we are going to play a game. And as one of my more devout listeners who's always posting reviews of my episodes on your Twitter, I know that you know which game is coming.
It's 20 questions, isn't it?
I'm not going to throw you any curveballs. I am going to play 20 questions with you. I have selected from randomizer.net one Doctor Who story between 1963 and 2022, not counting Legends of the Sea Devils, because that is about 10 days away from air. We are recording this on Thursday the 7th. That will air on Sunday the 17th. But any story from Unearthly Child all the way up through Eve of the Daleks, it could be any one of those stories. You have 20 questions to figure out which one. And go.
Right. Let's think. Is it a 20th century story?
Let me just ask. Do you mean set in the 20th century or made in the 20th century?
Made.
Yes, made in the 20th century.
Made in the 20th century. Okay. Is it in black and white?
No. Question 3.
Was it produced by John Nathan Turner?
No. Question 4.
Okay, we're getting there. So, is it a Tom Baker story?
Yes, it is. Question 5.
Does it feature Romana?
No. Question 6.
Right. We're narrowing it down then. What's the record for this? Who's got the best score so far?
Graham Burke got his in 8. And he was doing, well, you did a very methodical narrowing down of eras. I don't know if you're going to beat his record, but you're going to come very close.
Right. Okay. Sorry. It wasn't Romana, was it?
It was not Romana. That's, okay. You already asked that, so I'll allow that.
Just double checking.
Question 6.
Does it have Harry Sullivan?
Yes, it does. Question 7.
Oh. Does it have a returning monster?
Yes. Question 8.
Is it Revenge of the Cybermen?
No. And you do not tie Graham Burke for King of the Podcast. Question 9.
Is it Genesis of the Daleks?
No. What? Question 10.
Oh. Hang on. Terror of the Zygons.
I'm going to allow that question, but we said returning monster. They are not returning. That was their first story. So now we're on question 11.
Oh, my word. Hang on. It's got Harry Sullivan, returning monster.
There's only 3 choices, and you've already eliminated 2 of them.
Sontaran experiment.
Ding, ding, ding. Fraser gets it in 11. That is still second place, I believe. I haven't been keeping track of the scores. Maybe I should. But you came close to Graham's record. You gave it a good go. And next time, maybe you'll beat him. If he doesn't beat his own score the next time he's on the show.
Oh, fingers crossed. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, Sontaran experiment is not the most exciting choice to come out of the randomizer.
Well, but... it's really good example of how to produce your show, isn't it? Because you have 4 episodes in studio with Ark and Space, and then you take your location footage and you shoot an entire story on location. It's a really clever way of managing your budget, I think, as long as your lead actor doesn't fall down and nearly break his neck.
And Philip Hinchcliffe led to believe that he killed his lead during his very first episode as producer.
Yeah.
It looks great. Dartmoor is a great location. It's a character in the story. It's much more emotive than most of the human actors who are in the guest cast. And the restoration looks incredible. So you're talking about something that was done on video for 1975. You can buy on DVD the entirety of, for example, the 1975 World Series or the 1977 World Series, both of which are classics in U.S. baseball terms. But there's been no restoration done work on the video at all. So you get this bad quality degraded video from 40 years ago. The effort that Doctor Who puts into taking this video and restoring it, these things look as if they were shot yesterday, especially when you have the film, the videotape story on Blu-ray. So Sontaran Experiment looks great.
Yeah.
I don't think the writing is great. I don't think the acting is great. Tom Baker has not quite recaptured the intensity of his performance from Robot. He has not yet been given the actor's gift that is the Robert Holmes script for the Ark in Space, which is so defining of his Philip Hinchcliffe era Doctor. So Sontaran Experiment is stuck in the middle. He's injured halfway through. It's not a great Tom Baker story. And I don't think Sontaran Experiment is really anywhere in my top, half of Doctor Who. But even though it's not great, because it's Doctor Who, there's something to enjoy.
Yeah.
That's the location and the restoration and the fact that you can take this 1975 trifle and make it look as if it was shot yesterday.
Yeah, that's the wonderful thing that we're getting at the minute with these, Blu-ray collections, which I hope yours arrives very soon, because there's some things on season 17 which really scrub up nicely as well.
Well, it's 6:30 now, New York time, and I do not yet have the push notification on my phone that Amazon has delivered the package, and my doorbell has not rung. So it's also pouring rain outside, so maybe it'll come a little bit later in the evening. But I'm very much looking forward to season 17 and Galaxy 4, because I'm leading the eventual Trap 1 discussion on Galaxy 4, and it'll be really helpful if I had the animated discs first. They're now 2 days overdue.
Well,
so, Fraser, what's next for you in the podcast universe? You and I are both members of the Joe Ford Extended Podcast universe, but you are a much more frequent guest on his shows. So when and where can we hear more of you?
Funnily enough, you'll next be able to hear me on Trap 1 discussing the season 17 box set, which is due to be released tomorrow, I think. So by the time this is released, you will already have heard that or had the chance to hear that.
This will come out at noon Sunday on New York time.
Yes.
So my half a dozen listeners who listen to this as soon as it comes out will have already heard you on Trap 1.
Yes. Yep. That's all I've got in the pipeline at the minute. I do have a few other Hamster with a Blunt pen knives to record, and I think Ross Aitken is after another Gallifrey's Most Wanted from me and Cy Hart, so I've got that to look forward to as well. But everything else is in the archive, as it were. Oh, Stones of Blood. I'm down to do the Stones of Blood Target issue when that comes out in July.
And I am hosting that episode as well, because Stones of Blood is another one of those episodes that was very influential in my career path.
Hmm.
Which I'll discuss more when I host that Trap 1 over the summer.
Yes, that's not coming out until July, is it? So we've got a few months to go there. And then obviously, hopefully before then, I will be back discussing another novelization with you.
Yes, we will book you as soon as we finish recording. I'll put you into an open slot. So Fraser, where can we find you on the internet when you're not Joe Fording?
Well, when I'm not Joe Fording, when I'm not frozen in ice at Britannica Space, you can find me on Twitter. Is at Felix Fraser. That's all one word. As mentioned, you can find me in podcasts such as Trap One, Gallifrey's Most Wanted, Hamster with a Blunt Pen Knife, and I'm on Be Praised as well.
and, of course, Doctor Who Literature. Fraser, thanks again for joining the program.
Thank you very much for having me back, Jason. It's been a pleasure.
Good night now.
Good night.
Ah, thank you very much. That's very civil of you. Oh, my
you
word.
You claim to be able to help us.
No, I am sure I can help you. On certain conditions.
You are our prisoner. It is we who set conditions.
On the contrary, it is you who are the prisoner, and I can help you.
Not on your terms. Bring in the girl. Now we shall have two hostages.
Oh, what good will that do? You are buried alive in the heart of this glacier. Time is desperately short. You've got no time to bargain over hostages.
Inside our spaceship, we are safe. And with you here, your base will dare not use their secret weapon against us.
Weapon? But the ionizer is not a weapon.
You know how it works.
Yes, of course. It'll melt the ice and set you free.
You're hurting me.
Victoria!
Oh, Victoria!
Doctor!
Oh, dear, but they've got you too.
It's all right. We are not beaten yet.
What about Jamie?
He's alive.
If what you say is true, why have you not freed us before?
Well, there are difficulties.
What are they?
Well,
you will tell us.
Doctor Who and the Ice Warriors, written by Brian Hales, televised as the Ice Warriors, teleplay by Brian Hales, televised in November and December 1967, published in March 1976. The world is held in the grip of a second ice age and faces total destruction from the rapidly advancing glaciers. Doctor Who, with Victoria and Jamie, lands at a top scientific base in England, where they have just unearthed an ancient ice warrior. Aliens from Mars, preserved in the ice for centuries and now revitalized, the ice warriors feel ready to take over. Can the Doctor overcome these warlike Martians and halt the relentless approach of the ice glaciers? Brian Hales only lived long enough to novelize two of his six credited Doctor Who scripts, his adaptation of The Curse of Peladon, printed in January 1975, which we talked about on Doctor Who Literature with Ross Aitken from Gallifrey's Most Wanted back in episode 11, includes several scenes not seen on TV, but the prose was choked by extra verbiage that, as Hales might have put it, would be a daunting challenge for even the most courageous audiobook narrator to orally record for the impatient stalwarts in the captive listening audience, or something like that. But being one of the few Pertwee-era four-part adventures, the scripts that Hales was adapting were fairly tight, with nothing much to fix for the novelization, and so the book is fairly straightforward, with several deleted scenes added in. However, Hales' other novelization, The Ice Warriors, manages both to vary greatly from what was on TV and to actually impress with less overwrought prose. The Ice Warriors on TV is seen by some viewers, not by myself, as problematic, even though the story concept, production design, and acting are all first rate. As with the rest of Season 5, six scripts produced in Little Lime Grove Studio D result in a base under siege story with lots of padding. The middle episodes especially have to resort to marking time in a thimble-sized studio, which could barely house Totter's Yard, let alone a huge chunk of England. Hence, much of episodes 4 and 5, or, as they were called for the story on TV, 4 and 5, contain lengthy, static dialogue exchanges about moral concepts. Fraser Hines and Peter Salas, as Fraser and I discussed in the conversation earlier, are reduced to pre-filmed inserts, giving reaction shots to tigers and bears, at least one of the animals of which was actually in Ealing, along with them. Given the chance to tighten up on the budget and studio space imposed shortcomings of the TV serial, Hales writes a much more efficient book than he did with Curse of Peladon. The first two episodes take up literally half the page count. The Varga's awakening at the end of episode one on TV comes nearly a third of the way into the book. Then the episode two cliffhanger, where Varga exhorts his frozen comrades to awake from the dead, comes just after the halfway point of the book. Episodes 3 and 6 take up approximately about 1/6 of the page count. That leaves, you'll notice, very little space left over for episodes 4 and 5. The compression means that some of the flavor of the TV story is lost, but this is neither unfortunate nor fatal. On TV, Storr and Penley live in a plant museum. This term is applied in the novelization, but never quite described visually. Episode 4 loses lengthy dialogue exchanges between the Doctor and Leader Clint, and between Penley and Storr, but those were mostly circular arguments with nothing of Shakespearean quality cut out for the book. The cliffhanger to episode 4, with the Doctor trapped in the airlock of the Ice Warrior's ship, is much condensed, with both peril and resolution confined to the same sentence. And you can hear the resolution to that cliffhanger in the clip from the episode, which I put in directly before this review. Jamie is removed entirely from the episodes 4 and 5 material in the book, with the on-screen wilderness adventure, complete with the aforementioned reaction shots, omitted entirely. We also lose the Doctor making several detours en route to the Ice Warrior's spaceship in episode 4. Episode 6 on TV is preserved mostly intact for the book. Walters' murder by the Ice Warriors is simplified in print, and while Varga loses the awesome line, "At least I will live to regret it," he's given a much more dramatic and satisfactory death, as I read to Fraser earlier, saluting the potency of the enemy's ionizer in his final moments. Apart from the restructuring of the TV scripts, there's a lot to like about Hales' writing style here, especially compared to the Peladon book, although see episode 11 for Ross's alternate take on the quality of the prose. The world that Hales describes is faintly dystopian, with a hint of Brave New World about it. All humans in Britannica Base are rigidly categorized. Miss Garrett is a, quote, first-class technical organizer, unquote, although the security sergeant, Walters, is still described as burly. As with every Target book ever written, you can't describe a sergeant as being anything but burly. Storr, the scavenger, played on TV by wee little Angus Leaney, whose most famous movie character was nicknamed The Mole, is in the book big and, again, burly, with a wild, shaggy beard and has an ominous physical presence. He even knocks Penley unconscious at one point in the book, in a way that the character did not do on TV. This knockout blow, by the way, spares us the adaptation of another long dialogue exchange mentioned above. The Ice Warriors, for my money, are memorably portrayed in the book. As Mark Gatiss depicted them in the TV episode Cold War, they wear bionic armor, which is never explicitly stated on television in the classic series. Varga in the book is described as, quote, forever struggling to snatch in precious air, with the result that every breath, every word it uttered, hissed snake-like from that menacing head. The armor is more interesting here, with sonar capability on the breastplates, which glow and pulse, and much is made of Varga having superior and more lordly armor to those of his comrades. The story on TV was written before the series separated out the Martians into Ice Warrior and Ice Lord casts, but Hale certainly seems to have had the idea here, writing in hindsight. We don't, unfortunately, get many hints from Varga's POV about life on Mars, either to learn that Frequency 7 on the Ice Warrior's sonic cannon was used as a form of aversion punishment in prisons. For a full description of life on Mars, the world would have to wait 20 years for the publication of Craig Hinton's new adventure, God Engine. Of course, after that book came out, the world probably wished that it had been allowed to keep waiting. The violence quotient of the book is upped considerably, with Arden's death being particularly gruesome. Fraser did a dramatic reading of that earlier, and now I'm going to do the same dramatic reading of a shorter version of the same passage. Arden took the full brunt of the massive burst of sonic power. His body seemed to shimmer, almost disintegrate, beneath the invisible blast of energy. For a split second, he seemed suspended like a broken puppet. His face crumpled in agonized surprise. Then he slumped to the ground, as though hurled there by a giant hand. Folks, Fraser did it much better. We had a discussion earlier, Fraser and myself, about the way that Patrick Troughton's Doctor was portrayed in print. As I see it, Troughton still has a hypnotic effect on others. As the Doctor insinuates his way into Britannica's base and takes over the ionizer to prevent an early meltdown, Miss Garrett is described as helping him, quote, as though mesmerized by the stranger's personality. Another character, quote, didn't realize that behind the Doctor's seemingly innocent and trusting gaze was a probing intelligence that could, if need be, wrinkle the truth out of a giant clam.
Quick! Leave him!
He's in it! Experiments?
Magna Pylorus.
What?
Latin.
Never mind the Latin. Let's have a look at your foot.
Not that giant clam, by the way, from part 3 of Genesis of the Daleks. Music as well by the incomparable Dudley Simpson. Beyond the examples that I gave earlier, Troughton's impish spirit is also well captured in the book, with the Doctor writing complicated mathematical equations on the walls and muttering to himself. Victoria might not fare quite as well in print as the Doctor. Fraser and I had an interesting conversation about this as well. She does, in the book, faint twice and has one ridiculous pratfall early on. Hales does add the bit where Jamie and Victoria are engaged in their characteristic flirting. At the end of part 1, Victoria is sitting in the vibro chair and gasps as she feels the machine tingle into life, switched on by Jamie's eager hand, which, as Fraser and I talked about earlier, might well categorize as target pornography. For this portion of the program, I've been reading my review of Doctor Who and the Ice Warriors that I wrote for the Ratings Guide. It was written in June 2018. Fraser and I gave a very thorough accounting of the book and read several dramatic passages out to one another, so I'm not going to be doing the longer breakdown that I've done for the earlier books in the Target series. That's our discussion of Doctor Who and the Ice Warriors. The remaining Ice Warrior adventures were not novelized until the 1980s, both by Terence Dix, The Monster of Peladon, and The Seeds of Death. Discussion of those books will come along much, much later in the life of the Doctor Who Literature podcast. This is episode 21, as Ice Warriors was the 21st novelization published. The other books come out much, much later, so check back with me in a couple of months or years. No more inside information was coming, alas, from the Ice Warriors creator. Brian Hales passed away, only 47 years old, in October 1978, before he could get to the other books in the series. Several new Ice Warrior tales have followed in the original novels from the 1990s, and then in the new series, most recently The Empress of Mars by Mark Gatiss from 2017. I think, though, of the entire Ice Warriors canon, pardon the pun, if I could take only one Ice Warrior story with me, were I to be marooned on Mars, this would be the book that I bring. Thank you for joining me on this episode of the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. I'm Jason, your host and editor and producer. Special thanks to my special guest, Fraser Gregory. This podcast is brought to you by Anchor and can also be found on Spotify and Google Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, and you can also find me on the Trap One podcast from time to time. I have episodes in production right now about Warriors of the Deep, not about Galaxy 4. I write about Doctor Who on Twitter using the hashtag Doctor Who Pilgrimage, that's Dr. Who Pilgrimage. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Next time, we'll be discussing Doctor Who and the Revenge of the Cybermen. And we'll again be joined by a very special guest and a longtime friend of mine. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.